what I'd like to look at is are a couple of passages in the Megillah and ask a question, a very important question. When we study the Megillah, we're very enchanted by the story of... we're very enchanted by the story of Esther, and we're very enchanted by Mordechai, but what exactly was the motivation that Mordechai chose not to bow down to Haman, not to bow down to Haman? What was behind it? How does the text of the Bible itself seem to understand it? And what can we, so to speak, learn? What's going on in the story? So I'd like to look with you, first of all, at the story before the story. The story that leads to the story of Mordechai not bowing down. And so let's get a picture of what is the reality when we read the Megillah carefully. We've read the Megillah so many times, we sometimes jump over some of the key details. So if you look in the source sheet you have in front of you, it says, U'Mordechai lo yichra, at the top. It says, Mordechai would not bow down. So if you look at this is in the end of chapter 2. So Esther is ensconced in the palace. Esther has been told by Mordechai that she should not tell anybody where she comes from, what her origins are. And the Bible doesn't explain why. Ein Esther magedet et molarita. The top of Perek Bet Pasuk Yud Tet. Ein Esther, the second line, first end of the word, at end of the line. Ein Esther magedet molarita. Esther has not told anybody her origin. Kasher tziva lea Mordechai. Vet ma'amar Esther, Mordechai Esther osa kasher haita be'amnaito. And so she does exactly what Mordechai tells her at this point in the Megillah. Later on, roles are going to be reversed, which is one of the key elements of the entire Megillah story, how roles are reversed. But she does not tell, and the Bible doesn't tell us why Mordechai doesn't want her to tell. Now, we can have all kinds of, all kinds of conjectures at this point in the story. Remember, we unfortunately, or fortunately, as readers, we know the end of the story. But if you want to put yourself into the mindset of the characters, what is Esther thinking? Why is it that Mordechai does not want Esther to tell? What's the significance of that? What do you think? Everybody can ask. Everybody can participate. Yes?
But isn't it obvious? I mean,
nothing's obvious in the Bible. Later on, but how do we know? We don't see before the story, before Haman. We don't really see. And in fact, if we know something about Persian religion, in fact, the Persians were the ones who let the Jewish people return to the land of Israel, as it says in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. Cyrus the king, he's the one who made the great declaration allowing the Jewish people to return to the land of Israel, Hatzharat Koresh, as it's called. We don't have evidence prior to the Haman's ascension, that there is that much. But it's certainly a possibility. It's certainly a possibility that...
You don't go from benevolence to annihilation in one day.
Maybe, maybe not. But we don't have evidence beforehand in any other biblical book of what we would call anti-Semitism from the Persians directly to the Jewish people. We certainly don't have it at the beginning of the Megillah. At the beginning of the Megillah, we don't have that. Yeah. Correct.
Mordechai is not a Jewish name.
Correct.
There's something going on where the Jews are fitting in and they don't want to be seen as
Jewish. Okay, so maybe it's an assimilationist attitude, if you want to use our kind of terminology today, that maybe they just wanted to blend in. And so Mordechai feels, who knows? Yeah, what else?
Well, also we know that she's Yemeni. So maybe it's like the opposite, that she's like royalty. And because of that, like she wants to hide it because she would be like the elite.
Right, so maybe she just wants to be one of the girls.
Well,
like one of the...
that she'd be desirable to join the royal family if they knew that she was of the royal family.
So she doesn't want. So she wants to hold back so that people don't choose her and keep her in the back. That's certainly a possibility, yeah.
I mean, maybe based on the fact that she's looked at history, what just happened, really? Last she was just killed. Yeah, she was killed because she didn't come.
Right.
Hey, less information better.
Yeah, correct. On a need-to-know basis. I think that that's certainly part of what's going on. I think maybe everything that was said, I don't know for sure. Like I said, the Bible doesn't indicate to us what, and this is one of the interesting things, that's what's so rich about the Megillah, is there's so much mystery underneath the Megillah, things that we take for granted are not so obvious. Why is it at this stage of the game? I mean, Mordechai's not a Navi. Never says in the text that he's a prophet. He's very, very shrewd, but he's not a prophet. He doesn't know that it's going to be important at the last moment to reveal. We don't know. So it might be because of anti-Semitism, better to keep low. It might be because of assimilationist trends, another possibility. It might be because better to lay low so that you're not chosen, better not to be from the royal family, and better to lay low because look what's happened to Vashti. Maybe better to lay low, keep less information, the better, not to have anybody to use something against you. We also know something else, which is from the very next story, and again, whether we're allowed to project back is a good question from a literary point of view, also a historical point of view. We know that the palace is full of intrigue. As we said, Vashti was just killed. There's a lot of paranoia floating around because the advisors to the king can play on that paranoia and say, if you don't put an end to Vashti, who knows what's going to happen? The whole world is going to come apart. Every male, in the realm, it's going to be hefkerut. It's going to be total, who knows what's going to happen? It's going to undermine society. We also see from the very next story, which is the story I'd like to get to, Bayamim Hahem. In those days, Mordechai Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech. At that moment, Mordechai was sitting in the Shar HaMelech. Interesting. Where is Mordechai? Mordechai is not at home with his remote. Mordechai is not, working in the factory. Mordechai is Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech. What does that mean in biblical terms? If you open up your concordance and you look, what does Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech mean? Who sits in the Shar HaMelech? Well, yeah,
courtiers,
people who are part of the governmental structure. For example, Boaz sits in the Shar HaMelech, he's one of the nobles. Okay, in Sodom, Lot sits b'Shar HaMelech, many other places. So it's interesting, if you read the Megillah carefully, Mordechai is not some Stam, Tom, Dick, and Harry. Mordechai is one of the Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech. He is part of the governmental structure. And at that moment, Katsaf Bigtan Vatseresh, Shnei Sarisei HaMelech, Mishomrei HaSaf. Two guys, but not just two guys who were the Shomrei HaSaf. Sometimes we jump over that. What's Shomrei HaSaf? What's the Saf? The Saf? These were not just Stam, again, two guys. These were the people, it's like the Secret Service of the President of the United States. Anyone ever see the movie Air Force One, right? So the Secret Service guys, they are the ones who are plotting against the king. It's not some, general in some little base somewhere. It's the heads of the Secret Service. They are plotting against the king. Which tells you, of course, that the paranoia and the intrigue are real. That it's something that's very, very real. And also explains to us later on, when Achashverosh, when we find out in passing that there is a rule that no one is allowed to come before the king without first being called. Now you understand it, because his own Shomrei HaSaf, his own Secret Service detail, were the ones who originally revolted against him and rebelled against him. So this is a serious situation. Yeah. Correct.
And more likely they were protecting the women. They were the guards of the harem, of the royal harem.
No, it says Shomrei HaSaf. It says the simple reading is the...
Why would it be Srisim?
So what? A lot of people were Srisim around then, in those days, the eunuchs. The Bible also uses an interesting term, Katsaf Bigtan Vaseresh. It's a very interesting term. And again, the Bible is very interested in wordplay. That word has appeared before in our story. Remember where? By Achashverosh. By where? By the story of Vashti. When he decided to get rid of Vashti, when his advisors say, if you don't do something, uchidai bizayon vaketzef, there's going to be a lot of ketzef. There's going to be a lot of stuff going around. And it's also interesting, just to continue to connect the two stories, if you go back, two of the advisors of Haman, one of them is called Bigta in the advisors at the beginning, and also Tarshish later on. So it's interesting. Bigtan Vateresh, and here it's Bigta and Tarshish. There's a conscious effort to connect the two stories. Vashti rebelled against the authority of the king, and now we have another rebellion against the authority of the king, which puts us in the mindset of what's going on. And Mordechai is at the epicenter of that. And Mordechai knows what's going on. Vayivakshu lishloach yad b'melach Achashverosh. Vayivada hadavar l'Mordechai. And it became known to Mordechai. Just parenthetically, this is a topic for a different shiur, but since we're here and it's Purim, if you want to have a good time in the Megillah, and let's say you're getting a little bored, one of the interesting things is to look for the key words. One of the key tropes, one of the key words in the Megillah is knowledge. Lada'at. Who knows and who doesn't know? Umordechai yada. Mordechai knew versus who doesn't know. And Esther seems not to know what's going on to the Jews, and she has to be informed by Mordechai. And the climax, the crux of the middle of the Megillah, is when Mordechai says to Esther, Umi yodea im le'et hazot higat la'malchut. And who knows? Who knows? I know. Who knows one? Who knows if this is why you were ola ligdula, this is why you came to that point in history, to be at the critical juncture. So the question of knowledge versus not non-knowledge, the question of who's in the know, who's not in the know, this is like a crux of the Megillah. And Mordechai finds out, again, the Bible is very, very reticent to tell us, how does Mordechai find out? Was Mordechai one of the co-conspirators, meaning he played the double agent? Was Mordechai there in the planning stages, in the Sha'ar HaMelech, and then decided to turn in his co-conspirators? Does Mordechai, you know, hear things in, you know, at the cafeteria? You know, does he intercept some emails? The Bible is very, very sparse here. Chazal, in a very famous midrash, are very struck by that, and therefore Chazal say, "Oh, he spoke all the languages in the world, and therefore he was able to understand the coded messages." But it is interesting. Mordechai has knowledge that nobody else has. Vayivada devar leMordechai, vayyaged leEsther haMalka. He tells Esther, the queen, not just Esther the queen. It's an official communication. He sends it on official Persian stationery. Or, meaning, this is not just between uncle and niece, etc. Vatomer Esther laMelech v'shem Mordechai. Vayivukash haDavar. Again, the play on words. Vayivakshu lishloach yad. And they wanted to seek out and kill the king. And instead, vayivukash haDavar, the thing was sought out. Irony, reversal, one of the key themes of the Megillah. Vayimatse, vayitalu shnehem al eitz. Vayikatev v'sefer divrei hayamim lifnei haMelech. Now, if you woke me up 3 o'clock in the morning, okay, I woke up this morning at 4:45 to come to Toronto. So, but if you woke me up a little earlier and you asked me, what would be my expectation of the very next verse? Vayivukash haDavar, and it was written down. Achar haDvarim haEle, right after this event. You understand? Whenever the Bible says Achar haDvarim haEle, as the Rashbam and others point out in their commentary on Genesis, it always means there's a connection between the previous episode and the current episode. It doesn't just mean, okay, later on this and this happened. Whenever the Bible uses it, it means we as the reader are supposed to connect the two episodes. So what would you expect? Achar hadvarim ha'ele gidal ha'melech et Mordechai. That should be the expectation, as many people have written. And yet that's not what happens. Gidal ha'melech Achashverosh et Haman ben Hamedata ha'agagi. He puts in Haman. Now why does he put in Haman? Why doesn't he put in Mordechai? So again, the reader is supposed to start thinking about it. It's a jolt. So what do you think? Why is it that a king, knowing what has happened, why would he dafka go to someone like Haman and not a Mordechai? What do you think? You know? Doesn't say that in the text. Does not say it in the text. In the text it says Mihuman. Mihuman, which the rabbis in the Midrash are searching for a reason to connect the two stories. And they identify Haman with Mihuman. The rabbis are very fond of identifying people. One of my teachers when I was in college in NYU used to call that the law of conservation of personalities. Okay? That you don't want to have too many anonymous or people who we don't know floating around in a biblical story. So anonymous people get identified with people that are known. That's part of Darkei HaMidrash. That's part of the methodology of exegesis, the rabbis, of connecting everything together into a beautiful circle. But let's stick to the pshuto shel mikra, to the plain sense of the text. Why would we go to someone like Haman and not to a Mordechai? We don't know much. We don't know anything about Haman. Yeah.
Maybe Haman sometimes took credit for it.
Maybe Haman was able to maneuver to take credit for it. Even though Esther does, it says in the text, she said this in the name of Mordechai. But maybe she wasn't able to directly communicate to the king. She was only able to communicate to, you know, somebody down the food chain, as we say today. And it only got, by the time it got to the king, it was, you know, the evidence was doctored. Or the communique, other people took credit for it. It could be. That's an interesting theory. Yeah.
Well, it could be that in such an environment where there's conspiracy and plotting and so on and so forth, that they don't want anybody to get too high up. So perhaps if Mordechai was this very null person.
Right.
It was better to advance.
Right. Maybe it's better, you know, it's like almost like a basketball team or a baseball team when you want to bring in, you want to bring somebody from the outside. You don't want or a school. You know, like, you know, sometimes they think that the salvation lies in bringing somebody from another, you know, field or from another school rather than somebody internal. Right? Isn't that happen sometimes? You always look outside, even though this person may have worked in the field 25 years in the school and should have been promoted. But maybe it's better. Maybe Mordechai was too connected. Who knows? Yeah.
But isn't, I mean, Haman is identified as an Agadiv, so isn't he as much a foreigner as Mordechai is?
Correct, but maybe he's foreign in the sense that he hasn't been in the State Department for all those years in Foggy Bottom. Maybe he comes to it with a fresh perspective. Who knows? I'm just saying it's interesting. When I read it, my expectation, if I'm reading it seriously, is Mordechai should get this position, and instead Haman gets the position. Which also raises an interesting question to me, and that is, did Mordechai himself harbor any disappointment or harbor any ill will towards Haman for getting the plum job that maybe Mordechai... Meaning, once the Bible presents this, we have to ask ourselves questions like that. I mean, I think. Especially when we find Midrashim that actually talk in those directions. Yes, I'm sorry.
Even though when Esther went to Ahasuerus and, you know, and said it in the name of Mordechai, the whole grammatical syntax here, this whole pasuk, it's all second...
Passive. It's all passive. You're right. Vayivada, vayivukash. It wasn't vayivakesh. Right. Exactly. It's all passive, which again piques the interest of, you know, it's all happening second person, which may support the idea of the more and more Esther was removed and Mordechai was removed from it, maybe they didn't know Mordechai. On the other hand, maybe they did. Yeah. Right.
Don't be messing with me. Don't think, oh, you just play by the rules. You can get close.
Correct. Correct. That's certainly a
unpredictable.
Correct. Certainly. Like I said, bring an outsider in who has a new way of doing it, hasn't been tainted by this or that, and just, yeah. It's,
well, but also the money is scared.
Like, yeah.
A bit of a terror,
yeah.
You know,
correct.
Don't mess with me.
Yeah. Doesn't say that. Again, you have to read it carefully. Never says Haman until this point. The Bible introduces him here. If you look at it, The rest of, there's only two places where it has the entire phrase. Haman ben Hamidat Agagi. Here, and the very last time that Haman is mentioned, at the end of the Megillah. It sounds like he's being rolled out, as we say today, and introduced. And then he's being rolled out again the last time. So, yes, now I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I just want to be accurate. The text never says Haman is there before. We're so midrashified. I know that we don't understand that the text doesn't say that. Yeah.
I would connect it to the fact that Mordechai told Esther to stay under the radar, and he also feels that he's identified Jew, like in Mordechai.
So he was offered the position, but he turned it down. I will turn down the nomination of my party.
He doesn't want to fly a
Okay, so that's a fascinating suggestion. Again, it's a conjecture. Again, I'm saying we just don't have it. Yeah, could be, yeah.
Maybe Ahasuerus did not appreciate Mordechai that he didn't tell him directly, that he went through
channels. Right. Why didn't he come directly to me, you know? How come nobody's telling me what's going on? You know, it's like, you know, that king, you know, says, you know, how come nobody's, you know, helping me and doing this and stuff like that, yeah?
Well, especially given the paranoia and the fact that it's an internal conspiracy.
Correct. So these are all possibilities, and I think the author of the Megillah wants us to start thinking interesting questions. So the text now continues. As we mentioned, we're given a full-fledged presentation of his title, including his ethnic background, which is interesting because why do we need to know that? Obviously, for a reader of the Bible, there's only one connection that they can make. The last time we had Agag was in the story of Shmuel, the story of the lack of fulfillment by Saul of the destruction of Amalek, at least in that area. Clearly there were more Amalekites floating around. Again, I don't want to shock anybody, but there were clearly more Amalekites around because in chapter 30 of the book of Samuel, David is fighting the Amalekites. And it only happens a couple of years afterwards. So obviously, if David is fighting the Amalekites in Sefer Shmuel, Perek Chavtet, and Perek Lamed. Obviously, this is something. It just means in that area he was supposed to destroy the Amalekites, and so this Agagi connects us to that story. Of course, the whole Megillah is connected to the story of Saul's lack of ability to fulfill God's will and desire, and that's done on many levels. For example, the Bible tells us that Mordechai is a descendant from Kish. Kish was the father of Saul. That's the same name. We also are told that Ubabizal lo shalchu et yadam. When the Jews win, they don't take the spoils. Who cares? Why do we need to know that? We need to know that because it's a reversal of the story of Samuel and Saul, where they did take the booty improperly. So the Bible says here, Achar v'meila gidal ha-melech ha-chashroot raman, Vayinasehu, put him up. Vayasem et kiso me'al kol ha'tzarim asher ito. Again, careful readers. The Megillah is such a beautiful story, but we hear it so much, we forget. We have to read it carefully, like a pasuk in Chumash or Tanakh. It really is part of Tanakh. It has to be read carefully. Does anybody know where this phraseology appears? Only appears one other place in the entire Tanakh. This phraseology of Vayinasehu Vayasem et kiso me al kol hasarim, and he put his by what? Nope. I know you would think, because there's so many Yosef parallels, but this terminology does not appear by Yosef, but it appears what? Nope. It says by Shaul that he was you know vishichmo lamala, he was more, you know, handsome and more and taller than everybody else. But it doesn't say that. You know where it says? It's the very last passage in Tanakh, in Sefer Melachim. Remember the Jewish people went into exile in 597 first under King Jehoiakim. Remember the pre-exile exile, right? You can order, you know, the pre-exile exile, 11 years at the very end. Does somebody have a Tanakh here? No Tanakh? Is there a Tanakh in this room? I'm sorry, I would read it. Oh, thank you so much. When I left. Thank you very much. So in Sefer Melachim, the book of Kings, after the Jewish people are exiled. In 597, then 11 years later, they go into exile, the final exile. But that king Jehoiakim is the first diaspora. That's when the Jews settle in Babylon. That's when Yechezkel, the prophet, goes with them. That's when he starts to prophesy during that 11-year hiatus. The very last words, "Vayhi b'shloshim v'sheva shana legalut Jehoiachin melech Yehuda b'shnat eser chodesh b'esrim v'shiva lechodesh b'shneim asar chodesh." What's the 12th month? Adar. Interesting. 37 years. What's significant about 37 years since they went into exile? You know what's significant about 37 years? What's significant about being in exile 37 years? It's not a baseball statistic. What's the significance is because Jeremiah prophesied that they would be in exile for how many years? 70. It's half the distance to the goal line. In 37 years. So it says, what happened? Nasa Evel Merodach Melech Bavel Bishnat Malcho et Rosh Yehoiachin Mibeit Kelev Vayidaber Ito Tovot Vayitena Kiso Me'al Kisei HaMelachim Asher Ito BeBavel Veshinat Bigdei Kilo Ve'achal Lechem Tamid Lifanav Kol Mechayav. And that's the way the Bible, the story of the Jewish people in the Tanakh ends. That's the last historical event. Thank you very much. Is the restoration of King Jehoiachin, the last hope of Geula, of redemption. The one who went into exile now, it's the beginning of the process of redemption, is his whatchamacallit, his seat is put above. It's the exact same terminology. Vayinaseu me'al kiso. And here we have the challenge. It's the same period. Mordechai, it's during this period of time. The question is, who will win out? Will it be the restoration of the Jewish people coming back to the land of Israel? Which unfortunately doesn't work out so well. Most Jews like to stay in Galut. We like it. It's comfortable. Right? The story of Ezra and Nehemiah. Most of the Jews did not make Aliyah. Or is it going to be the, so to speak, the parallel? The one who is appointed above all of the rest of the Sarim, but, so to speak, the mirror image. The one, the Haman, who's going to challenge. That's what's at stake here. Jehoiachin. King Babylon, the king of Babylon, restored him. Remember, the Jewish people were exiled by Babel in 597. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in BCE. In 586 BCE. In 597, the king who went into exile was Jehoiachin, and he lived in exile for the next 35, 40 years. And in 35 years after they went into exile, they were the beginning of the Geula, so to speak, to use our terminology, starts. And it, so to speak, Jehoiachin's seat was placed above all the other nations that had been exiled by Babel. Mikol HaTzarim, all the other kings and nobles who had been put into prison. And now the Bible tells us, Vayasmin kisom yav kol asrim asher ito, v'chol avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech. Again, I want to read the story carefully. Because again, we have a certain conception from when we're little kids of how the story plays itself out. All of the servants of the king, Asher b'shar hamelech, again. It doesn't say everybody. It says, but everybody who was b'shar hamelech, which connects us, of course, back to Mordechai Yoshev b'shar hamelech. Korim u'mishtachavim lahaman. Also interesting. They bow down, two terms. I want to come back to that. Korim u'mishtachavim. We use that on in our liturgy, in Aleinu and on Yom Kippur. It's very interesting. It's a very rare terminology. Usually when people bow down, they either, it says in the Bible, if you open up your concordance, Vayikod Vayishtachu, they went and they bowed down, Vayishtachavu. Korimu Mishtachavim is a very, very limited term. It almost only appears in religious contexts, which itself is fascinating. Kichein Tzivalo HaMelech U'Mordechai Lo Yichra V'Lo Yishtachave. But Mordechai would not bow down. Now, it's interesting. again, when I was a little kid, I thought, what does this mean? It means, here's Haman, and here's Mordechai. It's like this, you know, that's like, if you look at some illustrations, it's like Mordechai and Haman alone, and Mordechai, you know, like, as they say in Hebrew, like, b'hafkanatiyut. He does it with, you know, like, consciously, he says, I'm not bowing down to you. That's not the story as it's presented here. In fact, Haman doesn't even know that Mordechai hasn't bowed down to him. If you look at the text, it says, everybody in the Sh'ar HaMelech, there's a lot of people. It's like a big crowd. And Mordechai's not bowing down. What do you mean? So Mordechai was in the back. As my friend Yoni Grossman has written, you know, it's like Mordechai found a way to always be in the bathroom or get a phone call whenever Haman came in. Mordechai made sure that it didn't happen. It doesn't say anywhere that Haman yet knows. Haman doesn't know anything about it. You know, it always reminds me of talking about, you know, being inconspicuous when you don't, you know. It's also a chachma. You might make sure, you know, when somebody walks in, to be inconspicuous in the back. One of my teachers, Rabbi Yosef Blau, he used to joke to us. He said, you know, when he was a high school principal for many years in a high school where the kids were a little rambunctious. Okay, and so the kids weren't so, they didn't stand up for him. He's a rabbi, but they didn't necessarily stand up when he walked into the room. Then he became the mashgiach at Yeshiva University. And then all the kids there, they came back from Israel. They were all fired up. They were very, very religious and all that. So they would stand up when he would walk in. And he said when he started there, he made him feel very uncomfortable when kids would stand up for him. He wasn't used to it. He says as time went on, he got very comfortable with it. You know, kids standing up. He said, within 10 years, less, he said he used to notice who didn't stand up, right? So he says, that's the challenge of honor, of you know, that you become like that. But here, nobody tells, Haman doesn't know. Who finds out? Vayomru avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech leMordechai. It's all the other guys who are upset. How come you're not showing up? You know, you're always in the bathroom. How come you're not standing up when Haman comes in? Why do we? We don't like Haman any more than you do. Why do we? Why does he have to treat us like we're servants? Madua ata overet mitzvat hamelech. Vayihi ke omram elav yom yom velo shama alehem. And here you're correct. The only other place where this phrase appears is in the Joseph story. When Joseph is seduced by Mrs. Potiphar, Mrs. Robinson, when he's seduced, and every day it says Vayhi ke'omram, when she said to him, come and sleep with me, and he would say no. Vayagidu lehaman lirot hayamdu divrei Mordechai ki higid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Just like, again, it's a parallel to the previous story. Just like in the story of the rebellion of Bigtan and Teresh to threaten the king. Here, Mordechai tells someone to tell the king. Here, these people tell Haman. Haman didn't know anything about it. Haman is told about it. Vayagidu. They tell Haman. Lirot haya amdu divrei Mordechai ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Vayar Haman. And then Haman goes out of his way to check out, is this information true? Ki ein Mordechai korim shtachav elo vayimalei Haman chema. Vayivez be'enav lishloach yad. The same terminology that's used prior here about lishloach yad by the story of Bigtan and Teresh. He doesn't, just as Bigtan and Teresh wanted to lishloach yad in the king, and Mordechai saved the king, here, in a sense, it's reversed. And here, he decides to go against Mordechai and his entire people. Now, from all the evidence that we've read here, let's try to figure out, okay? And of course, this happens again later on in chapter 5 in the story. Remember when Haman sees once again, he says, V'chol zeh einenu shoveli, this is nothing, because I see that Mordechai doesn't get up. Lo kam velo za, he doesn't get up. So I mean, Mordechai was given almost a second chance later on, and he still doesn't take the bait. Even after he knows the threat to the Jewish people already in chapter 5. So the question is, when we read the text carefully, what exactly is the motivation? Why is it that Mordechai chose not to follow Mitzvat HaMelech, especially given the fact that the setup was a setup where we find out that Mordechai was very loyal to the king. Mordechai was very loyal. Mordechai protected the king. So on the one hand, we get the sense, especially given the fact that we know from the beginning of the Megillah, we know that not following the dictates of the king lead to very bad consequences. And Mordechai is Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, so it's not like he's some little guy in the street. He knows exactly what the royal decrees are. And he knows that everyone B'Shar HaMelech is supposed to get up. And B'Davka, he doesn't do it. So it just raises the bar. What is the motivation of Mordechai? Yes. Because it says, again, depending on how you read, Kichen Tziva Lo, and most interpreters, to Haman, about Haman. Sometimes in biblical Hebrew, Lo means about him. Like, maybe Haman made it up. Correct, but clearly, look, it's certainly possible, but certainly the Kol Avdei HaMelech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech, certainly believe that it is the will of the king. Okay, and it says, "Achar hadvarim ha'ele gidal hamelech et haman vayinas ehu me'al kise." What is this phrase? Me'al kol hasarim. Three terms: gidal vayinas ehu mikol hasarim vayasem et kiso. It sounds very much like that's the simple story. That yes, they were accurately reflecting what the situation was. So why is it that Mordechai doesn't? Yes. Okay. So let's go through at least three possible readings here. Many people have written about it, both Jewish and not Jewish, in their analysis of the Megillah. And even Chazal, even the rabbis in the various Midrashim, go in different directions if you really look at the story carefully. One approach is to say, and again, this is an approach which finds echoes in Midrashim, albeit minority views, but as was said before, as was at least raised, may have there been a personal element here. Meaning Mordechai, expecting to become the next head, given what he had done, does Mordechai bear some sort of animus to Haman and what he represents in the sense of, he is taking my position. It's interesting, there are Midrashim, I'm sure many of you may have heard them when you were young, that talk about that, you know, Mordechai originally was the master of Haman and Haman was his slave. Have you ever heard of these Midrashim floating around? Yeah, those Midrashim, in effect, reflect a certain sense of, there was some, as they say in Hebrew, Mashuhu Ishi, there was a personal element here that has a history. These people had history going back. And it's not Stamazoi that Mordechai and Haman. That's one way to read it. I don't think that's the plain sense of the text. But there are people who speak in those terms. The rabbis, of course, other rabbis, were very uncomfortable with that notion, especially given the fact that the Bible here presents Mordechai, you know, and that's always another interesting question, is how does the Bible evaluate its characters? It's a fascinating question. Not how Natty Health God evaluates it, but how does the Bible... Now, sometimes the Bible is very explicit on its evaluation. I'll give you an example. David kills Uriah HaChiti and sleeps with Bathsheba. So the Bible is very explicit in its evaluation. Vayera hadavar be'enei Hashem. It says at the end of chapter 11 of Samuel, it was very evil in the eyes of the Lord what David had done. You can't get more explicit than that, where the Bible explicitly tells us what it thinks about it. But there are other times when it leaves it up to the reader. Here, it doesn't say, did Mordechai do a good thing? Do a bad thing? A neutral thing? The only way that we can determine is by the echoes. And I mentioned before that there's an echo here of the story of Potiphar, of Joseph standing with integrity and not giving in and not being seduced by Mrs. Potiphar. If you believe that the Bible here is doing that echo to say, you know, Mordechai was in the same league as Joseph. And Mordechai is, of course, a descendant of Joseph. He comes back. He comes from Binyamin, which is basically Joseph, Ephraim. It's all one big happy family, ultimately, the children of Rachel. Okay? So, the line of Rachel. So, if that's what the Bible is doing, so then it's evaluating what Mordechai did in a very positive way rather than negative way. So, I think the Bible... So, that's why I think the personal issue is not such a... It doesn't really come out for force. Yes? Correct. And there are midrashim that do speak about that, for example, and that's what I wanted to point out. Even if it's saying there are those midrashim who are not happy, for example, that, there's also another one. There's a midrash, you know, when Jacob, which I should have also mentioned, in the Bible, people bow down to people, even very frum people bow down to people without getting into trouble. Right? Yaakov bows down to Esav. David bows down to Shaul. This one bows down. It's not usher in the Bible to bow down to a king. Stamazoi, just like that. You can bow down to a king. It's not considered inappropriate as part of the political process. In fact, one second. And, I'm sorry. So the rabbis, but you, as you said correctly, there are midrashim in Parshat Vayetze that talk about Vayishlach, excuse me, that take Yaakov to task for bowing down so much to Esav. And they say, just as Mordechai, you should have been like Mordechai, not like, yeah, that's one midrash, which seems to say Mordechai had much more integrity and much more backbone and much more pride. He had Jewish pride. On the other hand, there are midrashim that say, you got us into trouble. What were you so, you know, you're being such a big pride guy. Maybe bend a little bit and it wouldn't have got it. So there's various midrashim floating out there. And if you want to, you can take a look in various places. Let me just continue. Because what time is it?
Oh, it's 10 after 11.
Okay, so let me try to get to the final point. The other approach, which the rabbis were very, I think were struggling very much. I think, again, as many of us have studied when we were little kids, the other approach is to say, well, Haman, the reason Mordechai didn't bow down was for religious reasons. Because Haman had Avodah Zarah. He was wearing, you know, like the priests, he was wearing some big cross. Now it's interesting, there's nothing in the text that indicates that, but you see the rabbis struggling with it. The truth is, interestingly, Haman, the name Haman is actually an Iranian, an old Iranian god name. Okay, just like Mordechai and Esther are also names of gods. In Babylon, Haman is an Iranian god name, an ancient Iranian god name. So maybe that's where the rabbis were rooting this from. The truth is, the rabbis also are basically imposing a story, another biblical story on the Megillah, which we know the rabbis like to do all the time. And that's the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We know that, you know, the three young men in the beginning of the book of Daniel, who basically lived a few decades prior to the Mordechai Esther story, or maybe more than a few decades, depending on how you date the Megillah. But they also lived in Babylon, chapter 3 of the book of Daniel. Anybody ever learn the book of Daniel here? It's part of our Bible. Gotta learn our Bible. So the book of Daniel, chapter 3, there is the famous episode in Bik'at Dura. Anybody watch Star Trek? You know, remember Duras? They got it from the book of Daniel. A lot of the names in Star Trek come from the Bible. It's also good, yeah. It's good to know. Okay, so in the obscure books of the Bible. Okay, so the book of Daniel in chapter 3, King Nebuchadnezzar, the great king, builds a big idol in Bik'at Dura, in the valley of Dura, and he commands everybody to bow down. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their names have been changed into Babylonian names, just like Joseph, just like Esther and Mordechai. They refuse to bow down and engage in the act of what we call Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, willing to be thrown into the Kivshan Ha'esh, willing to be thrown. That's where the rabbis took that element and put it into the Abraham story, right? A lot of the elements in Midrashim come from other biblical stories that are then reimposed on other biblical characters for many reasons, exegetical reasons, ideological reasons, theological reasons. That's not the point of this. So the rabbis, in effect, said, well, Mordechai, just like they didn't bow down, so too he. He didn't bow down for religious reasons. And as I mentioned, it's not so far-fetched because the term Kor'im u'mishtachavim as a term only appears in the Bible in religious terms. It doesn't really appear in other terms, like by somebody just bowing down to a king or a political leader. When Jacob bows down to Esau, it doesn't say Koreo Mishtachav, it just says Vayishtachavu or Vayikod, whatever the term is. So that's another approach, which is to say that there was some sort of Avodah Zarah here. Again, the text doesn't spell it out, but I understand where the rabbis are coming from. And the final approach, as was said correctly, is that it's not so much about religious, but it's much more about a kind of national, ethnic, religio, all the thing together, because the Bible emphasizes here, ki higid lahem asher hu Yehudi. He said that he was a Jew, as opposed to the Agagite, meaning already at the very beginning, Mordechai understands that Haman and his ascension to power represents a mortal threat to the integrity of the Jewish people, the vision of the history of the Jewish people, the unfold, whatever term you want to use. That already here, Mordechai understands that it's something about what we would call national religious, rather than just purely a religious Avodah Zarah term. And that's what Mordechai is doing here. And so, really, as I said, the text leaves us with a lot of silence, but we can try to tease out from our reading here of different elements that emerge from the text. And again, if you have time, and you go and you look at the various midrashim on this section, you'll find them pulling in the different directions. Is it because of personal issues? Is it because of religious issues? Is it because of the national historical enmity which is represented by the battle of Amalek and the Jewish people? And, you know, Kiyad al-Kesiyah, that God's hand will never cease to fight against Amalek and what it represents in the world? Is that what's going on here? Again, there's a lot of silence, and that allows the reader to try to tease out what the text is trying to say. Thank you very much for your attention and your involvement and your learning together this morning. I just published a book about a week ago and brought a few copies here. And if anyone would like to purchase it, there are a few copies here at the front.